There you go. We're ready.
Good afternoon. We're going to call this meeting of the State Department Veterans Budget Division to order. It's a little bit after 2:06, we'll say, on Tuesday, March 7th, 2015, and a quorum is present, if you can believe that. We have another committee meeting over on the other side, and a lot of their members are doing double duty, so we have them come back and forth, but we do have a quorum. So members today...
It's April 7th, not March 7th, for the record.
Oh, yeah. It's April 7th, in case any of you didn't think I know what day it is. All right. Members, today we have a lengthy agenda, but after this we should be done hearing anything that may be included in the omnibus budget bill. The bills today have fiscal notes, summaries, and handouts with the language, and when necessary, you have that in front of you. It is my intention to lay these bills over for possible inclusion. Normally, I would not have my bills first, but unfortunately, I have another engagement that I have to go to, so we're going to switch the agenda around a little bit, and I appreciate your understanding. I want to note that after today, we'll have a subdivision hearing tomorrow, conducted by Senator Carlson, and he'll complete his work tomorrow, right, Senator Carlson?
Yes.
And then the remaining hearing schedule will deal with finalizing our budget bill. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Senator Carlson, and I'll head down to the other end of the table. Get down over here.
Senate File 1868. Senator Saxog, at your pleasure.
Well, thank you, Senator Carlson and members. Today we have a presentation by the Public Educational Radio Grants Appropriation, and that's the Association of Minnesota Public Radio Stations, better known as AMPRS. And with me today is Joel Glazer to give a few words on the proposal.
Mr. Glazer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I am the Chief Executive Officer of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. As Chairman Saxog mentioned, that's a full name, so we simply go by AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities. AMPRS is an association rather than a radio network. What that means really is that if you could magically be in Grand Marais and Thief River Falls and Winona and Mankato at the same time, you're going to be hearing very different programming, because the programming is by and for the local communities as opposed to a network which is playing the exact same programming from one location. AMPRS is not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio, Minnesota Public Television, or the Minnesota Public Television Association. In total, we now have 17 community radio stations stretching as far north as the Canadian border down to Iowa and everything in between. 16 of those 17 stations are eligible for state funding. KUMM in Morris is not because of its size. The biggest news since I was in front of this committee last is that we have two new stations. We have WGZS in Cloquet, and that is serving the Fond du Lac band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And we also have KBXE, and that is in Bagley, serving the Bagley-Bemidji area affiliated with KAXE. So we've gone from 15 to 17 stations. AMPRS' mission and its member station's mission is really to serve underserved communities. What that really means is diverse and minority communities. We have programming in 12 different languages: Oromo, Somali, Hmong, and more. We serve rural communities and student communities. We have anywhere between 1,200 to 1,500 students in any given year who walk through the doors and the halls of our stations. That includes anything from behind the microphone, learning how to edit, everything from about fourth or fifth grade all the way up to master students and even non-traditional students. You'll have adults who want to learn how to do radio. That's not like community ed. There's not a charge. They can actually come in and learn how to do community radio. We rely very heavily on volunteers. Some of the stations are as small as two or three. Our largest staff only has about eight or nine, but they could have as many as 300 volunteers. and these stations are not allowed to run commercials. The stations are very entrenched within their communities. Very big part of what they are doing is emergency services. Unlike most stations where you'll hear a very quick 30-second announcement, in our stations you're going to hear an in-depth coverage of what's going on in that area. Forest fires are going through northern Minnesota. The fire chief will be on KAXE or KBXE for 15, 20 minutes, a half an hour, talking about exactly what's taking place, where they need to go. When there was a communications outage up in the North Shore, WTIP was the only possible method of getting word out because even the 911 system was down. So the Grand Marais station was able to explain how to call while the cell phones were down, what landlines could be used in that case. The stations work very closely with the emergency services and are very entrenched in their communities and their classrooms. Some of the stations give you a sense of just how local they are. They will cover school board meetings, high school sports. They all have to have a board of directors or a community advisory committee to make sure that they are truly serving their community and not just being run by the volunteers. Another example of just how local and just how publicly service-oriented we are, KVSC in St. Cloud is the home to the Central Minnesota Audio Newspaper, and that goes out to more than 400 homes throughout the area. This committee, I'd like to thank you for your continued support and for allowing us to present our request today. As far as our community service grants, we're often asked how those funds are used. It may not sound like a big deal, but a lot of that money is used to pay electricity bills. Running a radio station, the electricity bill is one of the most expensive things that we have. And in order to serve our community, in order to provide the emergency services that we do, we have to pay the bills. We have to pay the electric bills, rental fees for the tower. They pay their employees. But also importantly, the funds are used by most of the stations to help secure additional federal funding in matching non-federal funding dollars. As far as the equipment grants go, it is used exclusively for broadcast equipment. You're not talking about extravagant equipment. In often cases, you're talking about trying to replace a duct-taped wire with a wire that is not frayed. They have failing audio boards. The technology is changing rapidly. On the House side, I was asked about why we continue to need equipment. And the best analogy is if you think about your own computer or your own cell phone, you're typically having to replace it after a couple of years, not because you want to, but because you have to, and magnify that by about 100 times, and that's what the radio stations are dealing with. We are also asking for a one-time appropriation for emergency service funding. And the reason for that is there needs to be redundancy. When the emergency alert system is activated, what happens is there are two main signals that go out to all the commercial and non-commercial radio and TV stations. Here in the Twin Cities, that's WCCO and Minnesota Public Radio. There's redundancy. Once you get outside of the metro area, there is no redundancy. Outside of the Twin Cities, they are all on one tower. Minnesota Public Radio has two different transmitters, but it's on the same tower. So if that tower were to be taken out by a tornado, hit by lightning, those emergency alerts would not be going out. The Department of Public Safety at one point had asked us if we would be able to be the redundant for the emergency alert system and CAP, which is what they're transitioning to, another name for it. We had to say, unfortunately, we were not able to do so because the FCC requires certain things like backup generators and things like that that we do not have. That's why we're asking for the one-time appropriation so we can start building up that infrastructure so that we can be the backup system in those other locations. We're able to do so in all of our locations except one. In one case, we are on the same tower as Minnesota Public Radio, but all of our other non-metro towers are not on the same tower as Minnesota Public Radio. As far as our request, in the FY16, FY17 biennium, we are asking for a $275,000 appropriations for our equipment grant. That's an increase of $41,000. We would ask that you look at this on a per station basis. We are not a fiscal agent. The money does not come to AMPRS. We represent our member stations. These funds go directly to the stations. Because there are more stations now, that's only a 2.8% increase per station. On the community service grant, we are asking that the committee appropriate $920,000. That's a $136,000 increase, or a 2.7% increase. And the emergency services one-time appropriation that I mentioned, we're asking for $880,000 for a one-time appropriation for emergency services. And with that, I know you are on a tight schedule today. So, Mr. Chair, I wrap up my comments. I am available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Glazer. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, any further testimony from the audience? With that, Senator Saxov, I believe we are going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Sure, if you just lay it over for possible inclusion, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Saxov.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah. Mr. Chair, next I have Senate File 1644, and that's from the revisor statutes. It's an office complement increase and information technology services appropriation. And with me today is Michelle Timmons, revisor of statutes, and Tim Orr, deputy revisor of information services. Give a few brief comments.
Thank you, Senator Saxov. Who would like to go first here?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor of statutes, and I'll start. I believe you should all have a handout in your packet that is three pieces of paper, and on the top of it, it says Office of the Revisor of Statutes, Computer Needs Requests, Executive Summary, and I'll be speaking from that. And there's a core base request for the revisor's office. That's item one under the request summary. That is really what is contained in Senate File 1644. That's what I'll be speaking to today. The part two is about a potential new project, the Minnesota Administrative Rule Status System, or MARS project. And I believe several weeks ago you heard testimony about that from Kurt Kudelka from the Pollution Control Agency. I won't be speaking to that today, but I'll be happy to answer any questions. So to get started, I'd like to actually start with the page in the middle of the handout that is a table. And that shows you at a glance, this is a table that Tim Orr, the Deputy Revisor for Information Services, prepared. And it really shows you at a glance sort of the magnitude and breadth and depth of the computer services that are provided to the legislature by the revisor's office. So, for example, the House, Senate, LCC, Legislative Reference Library, and the Revisor's Office all have equipment over in the computer room in the state office building, but the Revisor's Office maintains the room. For the VoIP telephones and the Wi-Fi, it's the network administrator in the Revisor's Office who provides the core network and security services. We have a unique relationship with the Senate in that we actually provide the software for the assembly and the publishing of the Senate Journal. I think you're very aware of the bill status system that's on the legislature's website. All of the programming for that system is done by the revisor's office. And, of course, I think you're well aware of our publishing of all the laws, the statutes, the administrative rules, court rules. We now include the state register on the website. And on the reverse side of that sheet, you can also see at a glance just how popular the revisor's web pages are. This graph shows you how the hits have grown on the revisor's web servers, the ones that are part of the legislature's website. And so in 2014, we had about 300 million hits on the revisor's web servers, 4 million internal to the legislature from members and staff, and 298 million from the public, from the outside. So you know, with that background and the fact that we really do have major computer systems that serve the whole legislature, the base request is for $594,600 each year, which is for an addition of five computer staff, some rental space over at the Park Street facility because there isn't room for us all in the state office building, $56,500 for increased costs of software and hardware maintenance, and increased cost of computer hardware of $48,500. So just to put this in context a little bit, while this is an increase that we're requesting, just to put it in context, it would bring us to a total annual base of $6,270,100 per year, which is actually 96% of where we were in 2001. So I think what we're trying to do here is hold enough positions open to deal with the budget reductions of the last several years and hold them open in the attorney, paralegal, legal secretary, and administrative areas, but recognize that we really need to put more staff in the computer resources to maintain the systems we have and provide for the future. And on the second side of the page, it gives you the detail on the five positions. One is a network administrator, because, again, we provide all those core network services for the VoIP telephones, the Wi-Fi, and we have only one, so we have a single point of failure. One is a style sheet programmer. Again, we have a single point of failure, and what we want to do is convert all the style sheets into an open-source programming language and get off of a proprietary language. Web programmer, a second web programmer, again, a single point of failure, and I think the chart with the web hits gives you the information you need there. One web programmer just can't handle it all. For the Extend system, our drafting and publishing system, we need a tester. We don't have one at all. And we need about 1,400 automated tests to be created. And finally, a business process modeler to really analyze business workflow and try to improve the electronic workflow at the legislature. We're still very paper-intensive in the revisor's office and I think at the legislature generally, although the Senate does a magnificent job on the floor with your laptops. So that's definitely a bright spot. But I think we have a long ways to go in terms of creating electronic workflow and greater efficiency, and this position would really help us lead the way. And so with that, that would be the summary, and if there are any questions.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Orr, did you have any additional testimony?
Mr. Chair, I'm just here to answer questions.
Well, I have one question. I'm assuming that that the revisor's office formats for the small screen, and I think unfortunately right now it doesn't work on the small screen yet. Is that something you're going to be working on?
Mr. Chair, all the legislative offices are working on that together. We have made some...
Please state your name for the record.
Tim Orr, Deputy Advisor for Information
Thank
Services.
You.
Yes, that's an ongoing area of development that all the offices are working on.
Thank you. Any other testimony for this bill? For Senate File 1644? With that... 1644 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Go back to your spot.
Senator Pappas, I believe you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have 1663. Mr. Chairman and members,
Senator Pappas.
1663 is basically mostly a housekeeping bill for the Minnesota Racing Commission, but it does include two changes that are relevant to this committee. It has licensing changes that would allow multi-year licensing for certain occupations and modest license fee increases. These are long overdue and in step with other racing jurisdictions and will reduce administrative costs and are necessary to meet the legislature's directive saying that agencies need to impose fees on the racing and card playing industries sufficient to recover the operating costs of the commission with the approval of the legislature. So we're really here for your approval. We have some rulemaking authority. This is our third committee, and I have with me Mr. Joe Skurdo from the Minnesota Racing Commission. He's the deputy director for more details.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Mr. Skurdo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Good afternoon. My name is Joe Skurdo. I'm Deputy Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. The bill you have before you contains changes to clarify and simplify language within 240, Chapter 240, which guides the racing and card playing industry in Minnesota. The bill also contains two provisions or changes that have fiscal elements, which I will briefly outline. The modification in Section 10 would allow the MRC to change the current term of designated Class C occupational licenses from 1 year up to 3 years. Our intent is to only extend the term for horse owners initially, but provide the ability to implement for other classes in the future. This provision is something that was requested by our constituency as well as the horsemen's organizations. It is revenue neutral. A number of other jurisdictions currently offer 3-year licenses, including New York, California, Florida, Pennsylvania, and others. This provision will provide an estimated $75,000 in cash flow relief in fiscal year 17, but reduce cash flows in fiscal year 18 and 19. The provision would also have the benefit of reducing some administration expenses due to the term of these licenses. The second provision is in Section 12, which would remove the $100 ceiling on Class C occupational licenses. This change would allow the Commission, through a rulemaking process and with further approval from the Governor as well as the Legislature, to create new vendor categories and raise fees on those companies that benefit most from the industry or have the most influence on the operational integrity of card playing and wagering. Currently, there's a woman at Canterbury Park that sells fresh peanuts at the racetrack each year, and she pays a $100 licensed vendor fee. That is the same exact fee that companies like Bally's, Sport Tech, Scientific Games, and the local beer distributors pay. Gaming vendors in other jurisdictions, such as Iowa, pay $1,000 a year, Indiana, $7,500 a year, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, all $5,000 a year, yet Minnesota, it's still $100 per year. Additionally, by removing the cap, the Racing Commission would be better able to allocate the cost of regulation to those who require additional investigation and oversight. The Commission staff, stewards, judges, state vets, investigators, testing labs, just to ensure that trainers, jockeys, drivers, and card dealers are playing within the rules. Conversely, a student who is working a concession stand at Running Aces, per se, who requires very little oversight by the commission, pays virtually the same amount for his or her license. The change will allow us to provide a better correlation between our regulation activities and the associated cost to the occupation itself. The $100 cap has been in effect since enabling legislation back in 1983. Two categories of licensing were added in 2003 and in 2008, but there have been no general increases since at least 1999 that we were able to go back and find. The change is estimated to create an additional $107,000 in revenue, which represents a 12.8% increase in overall license fee revenue. But to reiterate, that is not an across-the-board revenue. What we are trying to do is focus in on the gaming vendors to generate the vast majority of that amount. In summary, if this bill becomes law, both of these changes outlined would still have to go through our rulemaking process, receiving input from industry partners, receive the governor's approval, and legislative approval. Finally, neither of these provisions outlined will have any impact on the state's general fund. I'm happy to answer any questions and respectfully ask for your support in moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Questions from the committee. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, because we're hearing a number of bills that are increasing fees, and so this is another one. And so on line 5.18, 1718, it appears that you get to choose how much it's going to go up. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, what we would do is go through a rulemaking process. So we would sit down with the interested parties, discuss, outline, and then present that through rulemaking.
Senator Gazelle.
So, Mr. Chair, members and testifier, I am a bit concerned about that. And like I said, this isn't the only bill. It's quite a few bills. There's significant fee increases, and I think as we're looking at them as a whole, I just want to say that it's caught my attention, you know, and this one in particular just happens to be what I'm talking about it. But, you know, it's not even going from 100 to 150. It's like whatever you want it to go to a point. And so I just want to express some concern for that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, I think that the rulemaking process will be, I mean, to pick a number now would be pretty arbitrary. And the rulemaking process will be a more deliberative process to figure out what the appropriate number is. I mean, the Racing Commission isn't looking to get rich off these fees, but they are looking to they have their legislative directive, as I read earlier, that they're supposed to impose fees. The legislature said impose fees on the racing and card playing industry sufficient to cover the operating costs of the commission so that we don't run into a situation where we're subsidizing this industry. They're supposed to do that to pay for their own regulators.
Yeah, Senator Gazelka, I'm told by counsel that there is a other statute that the legislature does approve these fees.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas.
Senator Gazelka.
I think I've just reached a point where I want to start addressing the fact that, you know, we're looking, I don't know what the total is from all of the groups that have significant fee increases, and I'm expressing concern. I would have rather seen, you know, I want you to meet your budget as well. I just, you know, I won't even mention the other group that was in here, and they wanted to significantly raise the fees so that they could audit everybody that they have oversight for every single year. And so it's just, you know, so I'm raising that awareness to say it's something I'm concerned about.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, Senator Kasaka pointed out one issue that goes to rulemaking. Are there other issues that are going to need rulemaking, be decided by rulemaking, you know?
Mr. Scuda.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the other rulemaking as far as the one-year license going to 3 years would also have to go through rulemaking to find out exactly which categories that would be extended to, the three-year licenses.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've always – well, we'll probably do it this time, but I've always been of the opinion that we should do the work here and not send it off to somebody else to do our work that we should be doing. So I just wanted to voice that opinion there. Sometimes we send things out of here that look like a chicken and they come back a year later looking like a parrot or something, yeah. You know, and that happens. And I just think – anyway, you're going to probably get your way on this one. But.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, if you look at page 517, page 5, line 17.
I'm looking at it.
The legislature has already told them that they have to establish this by rule. So I don't think it's their idea. If we wanted to, you know, do the analysis and do the work ourselves, we could. And I suppose as author, I could have done that as well. But it does say the legislature has already told them to do it by rule.
I see that, but I
Senator Metzen.
Just I've been very consistent over the years saying that when I chaired the GovOp committee and other committees, we tell in law what we want to do, not give it to somebody else. So that's I have to get that out every time I see this kind of thing. So
do you
Anyway, you're probably going to get your way on this one, but
we can.
Right, Senator Limmer.
Keep me out of it.
Okay.
Senator Anderson has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Skirto, you mentioned that other states have got a higher limit as far as a fee that they charge for their racing annual license fee. Do you know if those license, those fees are set by the government, the state government, or do they allow them to have the open and by rule allowing you, like you're asking for here, the same situation, or are they, as Senator Metzen said, there's a limit, a cap to these things?
Mr. Skirto.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, most of these fees are set by the racing or gaming commissions and then approved through typically the governor. Here in this state, it would be the governor and the legislature as well. So most of the commissions go through their rulemaking process for this so that they can meet with the interested parties, get the support, receive any feedback, and then go through that process. So, yes, to answer your question directly, most racing and gaming commissions do establish these, but then they are approved by either the governor and or the legislature.
And, Mr. Chairman, let me point out in your packet, and I assume they have these things, but there's our support letters from affected parties are in here from Canterbury Park and from Minnesota Harness Racing.
Senator Pappas, we did not get those attachments. Perhaps you could read off the...
Okay, I'm telling you. We have support letters from the Minnesota Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, and we have a support letter from Minnesota Harness Racing, and we have a support letter from Canterbury Park. No, that's it. But their intention is to meet with all the stakeholders, so it's a very thorough process.
Any other questions from the committee? Any testimony from the outside, from the audience? With seeing no more questions, Senate File 1663 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Senator Pappas, I believe you have another bill.
Mr. Chairman, it's Senate File 1176. This is a bill regarding military leave reimbursement grants. And let me just explain a little bit of the background. The Minnesota Veterans Preference Act gives members of the military, both active and honorably discharged, preference in hiring for government jobs, which is a good thing. As a result, many firefighters, paramedics, and police officers employed by local governments are also members of the armed forces and the Minnesota National Guard. Military service requires these employees to be away from duty while training or deployed. Local government units that employ military members are required by law to provide time off with pay to accommodate military service up to 15 days per year. There's no question that current and former members of the military make outstanding firefighters, paramedics, and police officers and deserve our continued appreciation for their service to us through the Minnesota Veterans Preference Act. However, this well-intended state law, augmented last year to give veterans increased preference, has come with a price that for years has been borne solely by local governments and property taxpayers. We are asking with this legislation that the legislature correct the unfunded mandate effect of this law. The legislation would set up a grant program administered by the Adjutant General to reimburse local governments for the salaries of full-time firefighters and police officers when they are required to fulfill their military duties up to 15 days per employee per year. The legislation will help our cities protect our local communities while our military veterans serve to protect our country. It supports both our military missions, our public safety response capabilities, and since fire and police make up the bulk of city budgets, it provides relief to the local property taxpayer. I have with me Mr. Chairman Chris Parsons, who's president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, for his statement.
Mr. Parsons, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. We represent 40 local union fired organizations in over 40 communities across the state of Minnesota, about 1,600 members. The fire service employs many current and former members of our nation's armed forces. In fact, many of the traditions of the modern fire service, from our rank structure all the way down to our blue uniforms, can claim their roots from many of the soldiers who returned to civilian life after our country's Civil War. Our state's fire departments are a natural fit for our citizen soldiers, and they have, by and large, proven time and time again to be assets to their respective communities. Add this, that Minnesota provides military veterans preference in hiring for government jobs, and it's no wonder that the fire service employs a disproportionate amount of former and current soldiers. This bill sets up a grant program to allow local government units that employ servicemen and women in public safety roles to recoup a portion of the costs incurred when these men and women must miss work in order to complete their military service up to 15 days per year. Minnesota statute requires public employers to provide paid time off in these cases. Minnesota has been a leader in supporting its members of the armed forces, especially in the area of expanding employment rights for veterans. In my 15 years in the fire service, however, I have witnessed how the paid time off provision can have a negative impact in the area of public safety. My employer, for example, the St. Paul Fire Department, employs roughly 30 firefighters that are also members of the armed forces. It's not uncommon to have around 10% of our department off on military leave when long-term deployments intersect with training weekends. In order to maintain our current minimum staffing number, the department must replace our citizen soldiers with costly overtime, which, including salary and benefits for a 24-hour workday, can exceed $1,000 per replacement. In 2014, the St. Paul Fire Department covered 602 shifts with overtime due to military leave. This, of course, is not just a St. Paul issue. It's a statewide issue, and it's proportionate depending on the community size and the department size. Minneapolis spends a similar amount to St. Paul. In fact, Minneapolis has been a leader in hiring veterans. The last 24 firefighters they've hired, 22 have been veterans. Duluth spends about $100,000 per year on military leave, and Rochester spends approximately $20,000 on salary, not including overtime costs, and the same can be said for St. Cloud. The Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport spends about $250,000 per year on military leave and associated costs. The other side of this coin is what happens when budgets shrink and belts tighten, as they did during our most recent recession. In St. Paul, as in other cities across the state, the answer often was to operate fire companies below national minimum staffing standards or to shut them down for the day completely, which meant a reduction in service to our communities. Understaffing is also a danger to firefighters and has proven to be a significant factor in firefighter injuries and fatalities. Therefore, in order to relieve some of the strain on our fire departments who employ service members, I ask the committee to support this legislation. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I support what you're trying to do here. I do have a question, though, related to do we have any projections of the military leave going forward? Is that number going to decline a little bit as or do you know?
Mr. Parsons.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazalka, in my estimation, I don't have any hard numbers on that, but in my estimation, the numbers of veterans that have been hired in recent years have either been steady or have increased. Especially when you're looking at the cutbacks in our current military, we're going to be seeing more people leaving military service and seeking employment in public safety roles. To answer your question, it has been steady. If not, we've seen an increase in veterans.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazalka.
I guess I was thinking about if we're cutting back on those in the military, that's where I was asking, does that then also correlate that we would have less projected time off for, I'm assuming, going to serve or train or whatever. That's what I'm wondering, if there's a correlation there.
Sure. Well,
Mr. Parsons.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, when these folks leave full-time military service, many of them do still remain in the reserves or join the Guard, and therefore they're, you know, subject to military training while they're in their civilian jobs.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that in 2017 they're asking for a half FTE, and then in 18 and 19 two FTEs, and I'm just wondering our explanation for the reason for more full-time positions for this situation.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, you're asking for why it's half-time and then why there's a full-time position. You know, we have to look at the fiscal note. I mean, my assumption would be that, I don't know. Let's look at the fiscal note.
Well, ma'am, Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, I know that right now, I know from my military retirement, it all comes through a computer system, and I don't see a check or anything. Everything has been computerized, and everything, when I was in reserves and in the Air National Guard, everything had gone on computers. So the reason to put more people on, I'm kind of bewildered as to why we need more, when right now it's been pretty good.
Senator Anderson, fiscal could give us a little bit of insight in this.
I think if you take a look at the fiscal note, on page 3, the fiscal note was prepared by the Department of Military Affairs, and they're talking about the need for one FTE to do the processing of the grants and so forth, and that they don't have any staff dedicated to carry out the provisions of this bill. And I think the reason that it starts out with a half a FTE and then goes to a full FTE has to do with the timing of when the grants start. I think they start halfway through the fiscal year, and so that's why they're starting out with less FTE, and then once it's a full fiscal year, they'll be going to the full FTE.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson,
to that, I think the backing down of at least from what I hear in the news and from what I hear from congressmen, they're talking about backing down on the amount of military people that are going to be involved here. So to say that we're going to need more people to pick up on this issue, it seems like it's it doesn't make sense to me to have to do that. But I understand where they're coming from, saying they don't have it, but yet they're still doing this right now electronically for all the retirees and people that are coming off of active duty into the reserves, and I haven't heard complaints about that yet. So,
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and, you know, Senator Anderson, I think we all kind of share the frustration is whenever we have a new program, it seems like the state agency always needs more people to administer the program, and sometimes it's shared among a variety of people, but it is additional duties, is how it's been explained to me. It may not be they hire one person, but that they have to dedicate, you know, 20% of this person's job and 20% of this person's job to do the program. In terms of the need, though, I think that as the military reduces itself, they do seem to be relying and have been more heavily on the National Guard. So that is our people who are in civilian life but then get deployed for military action. And wars don't seem to be stopping as much as you and I might want to see us, you know, phasing out. We phase out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and then something happens in Yemen and Libya and Syria and other places where the U.S. military is still engaged.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, each squadron, each Army unit is only allocated so many people. They can go over 10. They can go up to a 10% overage on the amount of people that they have, and then they can't take any more. So unless we increase the amount of money coming from the federal government and from the state to increase that amount, they're pretty well subject to a limit and a cap. So I'm just wondering, is there something in the works that I'm not aware of that they're going to a 15% or a 20% overage on the number of people they're going to have in the military, whether it's Army or Air Force or the Air National Guard.
Yeah, Mr. Pappas. Chairman, I don't know, Senator Anderson, you probably know more about them than I do. This is a cap program. There's only so much money we're putting into the program, and it won't fulfill even the current need right now. So as more cities apply for the reimbursement program, it's prorated to everyone. So it's not an open-ended appropriation.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I agree with the program. I like the program. I just don't know. I haven't heard a good explanation as to why we need more people involved in it.
In administering it, you
mean? I understand that.
Okay.
Senator Metzen, do you have a speech to make?
Mr. Chairman, I think we've got some good listeners here, and my colleagues are coming on board on some of this stuff, all this excess spending. Right?
We're learning from the pros.
I'm not giving my speech on this. I do have a... No.
Any other testimony? Any further testimony on Senate File 1176 from the audience? Seeing none, Senate File 1176 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Now, Senator Limmer is next. Senate File 1923, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1923 is a request for funds for a part-time legislative staff. I'm sorry, not a legislative, a staff research person to work at a 0.43 FTE percentage for the Legislative Coordinating Commission's responsibility or the Commission on Data Practices. Members may remember two legislative sessions ago, we created a commission to study data practice issues. And as a result, commission was formed. It has members of both House and Senate members on it. They meet during the interim. And as I begin, I'd like to thank Senator Dibble for also co-authoring this bill with me. He, Senator Kent, and myself are the Senate members on the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. A little bit of an opinion from me. I've studied data practices for about 20 years now in the state of Minnesota, and I think we've kind of lost our focus. And that was the general reason why we created a commission to study data practices, new technologies, the ongoing list of issues that come up all the time. Right now, we are beginning to, well, we studied this last fall. We got into issues like body cams for police officers, drones, the ability to locate your cell phone by a law enforcement officer. You may remember we created a search warrant for that purpose rather than just having law enforcement decide whenever they wish and for whatever purpose. We installed some due process into that, which was a smart thing to do. We studied traffic enforcement via cameras. That definitely is on the horizon where a police officer doesn't have to be on a freeway, only a camera has to, and we're beginning to study that type of issue. And of course, there's all of the myriad issues of healthcare applications for patient data. And Minnesota currently has a little bit stricter treatment of data practices regarding health and patient data than the HIPAA laws and the federal government. And then, of course, there's always new corporate technologies that are coming up all the time. And quite honestly, they are leaping ahead of us by quantum leaps ahead of what we can keep up with. That's why we created the Commission on Data Practices. We did not have much of a budget this last time, and we're requesting this halftime person to be a part of it in the upcoming biennium. I also have a few citizens that wish to give testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Lumber.
I could answer any questions right now if their members had any.
Any questions from the committee? Perhaps you could call your testifiers from the audience, Senator Lumber. Mr. Neumeister, please state your name for the record and continue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I have been around a very long time dealing with privacy issues, information issues, and particularly with you, the legislature. This is, again, historically almost nearly 38 years now. And one of the things that I've constantly seen is the issues are becoming more complicated, takes more time for policymakers. And that's one of the factors why this commission was formed last year, to focus on some of the issues that I'm hearing some of your colleagues already starting to say last year and this year. Well, isn't that an issue that this new Privacy Study Commission can look at? And I hear that, and as you know, from Democrats and Republicans. And so people are starting to recognize the importance of this commission. Secondly, though, is that it's important to have some staff to be able to do a lot of the information gathering, some of the research, some of the things that are important for this group and for you, the policymakers, to be informed on the new technologies that are happening, and also what kinds of laws do there need to be or to have updated. Now, I look around the table here, and I've interacted with most of you in one way or another on technology, changes of policy, and as privacy. I know two members of this committee, Chair Saxhog, and also Senator Stumpf, several years ago, was a little thing dealing with driver's license enhancement. So a lot of their constituents can go between the borders. Well, as you know, it was a little smart thing in it. And as you may know, at least Mr. Chairman, the Chair Saxhog may remember, when Leroy or Senator Stumpf handed off the bill to you, then I got to know you a little bit. And so those were the kinds of things, you know, we work on, but technology is exploding ever more. And so to develop some type of in-house with a privacy commission like you do with legislative pensions or whatever is an important thing. And this is not new. Other legislative bodies are starting to recognize this and doing those kinds of things in other states. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think this is a very important thing to do. As you know, a number of issues are still coming out, and I'm sure the body, is going to be talking about license plate readers, which this Privacy Study Commission also worked a lot on and made some recommendations, and I'm sure. So you'll see it's involved in a lot of bills and a lot of legislation. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Gazelka, a question.
Neumeister. Just one quick question, because I do see you around here a lot. I appreciate that you are involved on this issue. The Commission on Data Practice, then, from your vantage point, you think it has been a useful tool so far? Because not always do I think commissions do what we want them to do, but do you think it's pointing us in the right direction?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Gazelka, yes, definitely. I mean, again, there are four members, or I think Senator Brandon Peterson is on there too. A lot of these issues are bipartisan. You know, they're not like party. But one of the things that when people who are interested to serve on that body, they help educate you mm-hmm. when some of these issues come about. So that's one of the very positive things about this commission. You know, that you're developing expertise, awareness. And as you all know, as policymakers, there's a lot of collegialness on the floor and other ways. Hey, did you hear about this? What's your commission doing on this or that? And I think the commission can be a very important factor in those kinds of ways, too.
Thank you.
Senator Lumber.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Gazelka's question, I've been in the legislature for a while, and I think about 6 years ago, I think we began to lose a little bit of our focus. It was probably the wrong thing to do, but it was inadvertent. Technology is growing faster by leaps and bounds than we can keep up with, and the reason I say 6 years ago is that that was the last time we had a subcommittee on data practices in the Senate, and I think in the House. And it's an area of law that's rather obscure. It covers a lot of territory and ground. Does the public have notice? Are there costs involved? Who gets the information? Who does not? If you believe in the concept that knowledge is power, then who do you give that knowledge to, and who do you deny that knowledge to? All of these are policy questions that should be discussed in detail in order to get that balance between protecting private rights versus finding a public good, and find that fulcrum or that balance that we need to have on all policies. We have not made it our focus, and so therefore this commission is necessary. I have with me here Mr. Gemberling, who'd also like to make some comments.
Mr. Gemberling, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Gemberling. I'm the spokesperson for a small organization called the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. MNCOGI, which is the acronym, is essentially composed of media people, attorneys, librarians, and some just citizens. Our focus is on information issues. Our primary focus is on doing the best we can to assure that the legislature makes policy that uses information to enhance governmental accountability. When the legislation creating the commission was enacted last session, we strongly supported it. You've already heard some of the reasons why it should be supported. And what this bill does essentially is it gives it a little bit of staff to help move that process along. I'll give you an example of the kind of thing that often comes up. Somebody will say, well, what are other states doing on a given topic? And, you know, these days that's fairly easy information to get, but you have to have somebody to go get it, okay? And at the moment, the commission is essentially subsisting on volunteers, okay? There was volunteer staff that was offered from people in the House and volunteers like, frankly, myself and Rich Neumeister. And living on volunteers may be financially good, but keep in mind, living on the two volunteers that are in this room, you're running the following risk. Neither of us are getting any younger, okay? And so you really do need, among other things, to create institutional memory and to have that institutional memory available to you within your own staff. You know, at some point, I might take my toys and go home just because I get ticked off by having to be here. So, and keep in mind, we are volunteers. So things like who pays for parking are personal issues to us. And we do it because we care about it. We think the issues are important. And we like to help you do your job in the best possible way. And you can do that job much better if you get a little bit of staff to help you. And thank you for your attention, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Gemberling and Senator Limmer, I have a question that, in fact, Mr. Gemberling brought a little bit closer to the surface. You're asking for a part-time person, and this is an extremely high-tech assignment, and it requires very specific knowledge, and also it's moving very fast, too. And I'm wondering if a part-time person is adequate. Can a part-time person keep up with this? Unless you already have someone that might be a Mr. Gemberling or a Rich Neumeister that already volunteers or already is involved, can you handle it with a part-time employee assigned part of their day to work on something like this?
Mr. Chairman, if I can take that.
Mr. Gemberling.
I think you're on to a very good question. If I had my druthers and looking at the experience of other states and other countries, you'd have a whole lot of people working on this, okay? in part because so much of the discussion deals with technology and whether or not we can get ahead of the technology curve at least a little bit. I give you an example from another country. In Canada a few years ago, they got into a long discussion about how to protect privacy. And some bright member of the Canadian Parliament said, you know, what are we talking about when we talk about protecting privacy? Do we even know what that means? And so the commission in charge of privacy issues in Canada basically had staff go across the entire nation of Canada, set up public meetings, and make sure that those public meetings weren't attended just by lobbyists, but were attended by citizens of the nation of Canada, to deal with the following topic. What does privacy mean to you? And they produced a wonderful report that I still have a copy of, but they were only able to do that because they devoted staff to it. So in their discussions then, and it, you know, after that, when somebody would say in a parliamentary hearing, we have to protect privacy, they were able to say, well, in this context, what do you mean by that? Okay, what are the balances? What are the trade-offs? And much of that discussion involved technology. Historically in Minnesota, you did have a privacy study commission at one time. That was back in the mid-1970s. The commission existed for 2 years, and the staff for that commission was actually two people, an executive director and a staff person. And that staff did produce some fairly significant work. I mean, if you wanted me to, I could go into the Data Practices Act and show you places where that work produce public policy that you enacted. So I think you're right, Mr. Chairman. It would be helpful if you had more than a half a person, but that obviously is up to you folks.
Senator Anderson, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer or Mr. Gamberling, half a person doesn't seem like too much when Mr. Gamberling, you already mentioned that back in the 70s, we had two people working at this. So the staff you have right now is none, I take it, except for those who are volunteers and are willing to be a part of that. Where is the LCC housed as far as a location? Is it within Department of Administration, or is there any place specifically that it falls underneath the heading?
It's in the legislature.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
This is a product of the legislature. And the LCC oversees it, and grants it. It's
the boss is there.
Well, maybe we have another witness to answer that question better than I can, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. We're an office within the legislature. The commission is made up of 12 members, 6 from the Senate and 6 from the House. Our offices are located on the ground floor of the state office building.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to say there's some wonderful members on that committee, Mr. Hubinger.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I said you have wonderful members on that committee.
Yes.
I'm on that, yeah.
Do good work, really. Seriously, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, I am concerned about having enough horsepower in this. And I think I can say, I want to relay a little story about not that long ago. A friend of mine was in France, went to an ATM and put in her card, and she just happened to note what time it was when she did that, and got a cash advance. Then when she came home, she said, my gosh, the cash was pulled out of my account at the same time I put my card in there. She didn't realize that before she got a nickel, that had already been pulled out of her account. And you know, and I think people don't realize that when you put your card into the gas pump, it's already reserved an amount out of your account before one drop of gasoline goes into your car. There's this instantaneous communication that's happening, and all you need is to have someone in between there, and then they are getting
the cash from you, and you're not. And there's, I think, and Senator Saxaw, when we talked about the enhanced driver's license, there was that instantaneous readership also when a person would put that card into the reader when you crossed the border. They could tell whether you had a DWI, for instance, and then you would be denied. So there's
Mr. Chair, you didn't have to put it in the reader. They see it.
Yes.
Coming. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we're headed much further down the road, you know, with license plate readers, for instance. There's a number of databases that can be accessed at the same time you're driving down the street and reading plates. And it's not going to be very long that, you know, and by the way, I think Google still does, you know, the license plate. I think they still make them obscure them somewhat. But I know that in my case, a friend of mine told me that he needed to find out the name, a person's name that ran into him, and he let him go I think it was 35E, and I looked up his name to information that I happened to know, saw his address in South St. Paul, went into the mapping function, and lo and behold, there was the car that ran into my friend sitting in front of his house, and I could zoom in and see that there was a dent in the corner that my friend said was dented when they parted. So there's that kind of information that's available to us, and it's practically instantaneous now. So I think this is a major and serious issue that we need to address. So I appreciate you bringing it to the legislature, Senator Lindner.
Chairman, I think your example is only one. I think everyone at the table probably can think of very easily a problem that is being caused by high technology and sometimes very loose privacy controls in order to protect the consumer. My background is in private business, and I also know that one can undercapitalize an effort to the point that it's guaranteed to fail.
Yeah.
And so I hope you realize that that's exactly the perspective that I and Senator Dibble and others are seeing this need for Minnesota state government to regain its posture and its focus on data privacy.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Any other questions from the audience? Any other testimony? With that, we will lay over Senate File 1923, laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Senator Limmer. And now we have Senate File 1192, which is offered by Senator Dietzick, but Senator Rest is going to be pitch hitting for Senator Dietzick. And Senate File 1192, Senator Rest. And Senator Rest, I believe we have an author.
It's not an author's amendment. So I'd like to present the bill first before we have the amendment.
Okay, thank you, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1192 is a proposal that Senator Dietzick has been working on with the Department of Revenue, and it is designed to bring fairness to the Tobacco Tax Administration and enforcement to reduce smuggling of contraband tobacco products. In 2013, the department was required to study and report on the issues using an independent evaluator. The bill that was originally drafted established a new retail license for selling tobacco with additional fees. But in the course of the discussion on this bill, that was deemed to be not necessary. And so the Department of Revenue decided to work within the system that currently exists and not create additional bureaucracy. What the bill does is to set forward civil penalties for failure to comply with the statutes and the regulations regarding stamps and licenses for retailers, and creates a process for revoking a cigarette tobacco retail license with notice and due process procedures similar to those used when someone attempts to evade paying other taxes. It also establishes a process to regain a license that has been lost with revocation. It does not address the and does not restrict local governments from revoking licenses based on other parts of the statute. This is solely dealing with contraband sales of cigarettes. The Revenue Department currently has authority to publish a list of delinquent taxpayers, and this bill allows them indeed to publish the list of revoked tobacco sales product licenses with a prior notice process. And similar to some other financial crimes, a person may sell a small amount in multiple locations that may be across county lines. But if you add them all up, it's a large amount. The bill allows any prosecution of unstamped or untaxed tobacco products sold or purchased in violation of law within any six-month period to be aggregated. The bill also adds a felony charge for willful failure to pay the taxes. The felony charge aligns with the tax provisions for income, corporate, and sales and use taxes so that similar offenses are dealt with in a similar manner. It was the bill was amended in the Judiciary Committee to address those changes. There is an amendment that you do have before you that adjusts the appropriation request based on the changes that were made in the Judiciary Committee, and it also increases a penalty so that it truly impacts those that are flagrant violators, and the bill also, the amendment also makes some technical changes to improve the clarity. So, Mr. Chairman, if someone would be so kind as to take a look at the, I believe it is the A6 amendment.
A1.
It's the A1 amendment that combines two prior amendments. The first part of that is the technical changes, and the lines 120 to 123 reflects a revised and lower fiscal note. Even though this is a tax issue, by the way, the leadership, Senator Cohen, Senator Scoy, Senator Saxhog have agreed at this point that should this provision and bill go forward, that it would be initially included in the State Department's finance appropriation bill, and what other disposition of it later on in the process would be handled at the leadership level. So, Mr. Chairman, I would request that someone move the A1 amendment.
Senator Saxhog moves the A1 amendment that makes technical changes and adds the appropriation. Any questions on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Jenny Starr is with me today, who is the Department of Revenue Assistant Commissioner for business taxes, and she stands ready to answer any questions that you may have about the process or about the bill itself or how the Department of Revenue operates with regard to contraband cigarette taxes, if members would like to inquire of her about that.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the cigarette distributor license fee, so that would be, I'm assuming that's like a gas station that's distributing, or who is that? Because I'm looking at that fee that's going.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, what line of the bill are you
under arrest?
I'm sorry, I'm looking at the fiscal note on that we're looking at. On page two of that. You know, so I don't know where it is in the bill. I guess I could look it up, but I just saw that it went from $300 to $500. And if that's all the folks that sell it, is that the distributor? And if that's is that not the case?
There is in section four of the bill, the fee is raised for a license from $300 to $500. To distribute the cigarettes, and then from $24 to $100 to apply for a license as a cigarette sub-jobber. And the fee is raised from $75 to $500 to apply for that distributor's license. Again, that's in Section 5 as well. And from $20 to $100 to apply for the DePaco product subjobbers license. So, and those fee increases would be effective December 31st.
So, Mr. Chair, and
Senator Gazelka,
to Ms. Starr, so is a distributor then, would that be like a gas station, or is that, who is a distributor?
Ms. Starr, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Business Taxes at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, to your question about who is a distributor is not your retailer, so it's not your gas station selling cigarettes to you, to anyone as an individual consumer. It's the distributor who sells to the retailer itself.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions from the committee? Any further testimony, Senator?
No, sir.
Thank you very much. Senate File 1192, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you, Senator Saxon.
Senator Franson. Senator Franson has Senate File 1476. Senator Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1476 comes from the Office of the Secretary of State, and it's a business technical bill. Basically dealing with two fees and making them flat fees per filing. One of them is the federal tax lien fee, and then the second one would be the reinstating the foreign corporations fee. And there's a couple of also housekeeping miscellaneous changes in the bill. And to go into further detail, I have with me Mr. Burt Black to talk about the details of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Mr. Black, nice to finally meet you face-to-face. I know we've talked many times. So please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bert Black. I'm a legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State. Every year we ask our employees, what are the things that you believe, and we ask others, what are the things you believe would help streamline your filing process or the filing process? And so we have in this bill a mixture of both fiscal and policy sections. I'm only going to talk about the fiscal sections, which are sections 1 and 2. The first section has to do with federal tax lien fees. We have received federal tax liens from the IRS for over 20 years. Right now, the statute says it's $15 for the first two names and $15 for every debtor named thereafter. Unfortunately, it is not possible under the current computer system to tell or to determine the fees accurately when you have more than two debtor names. Last year, in 2014, we had 21 IRS tax liens that had more than two debtor names. At $15 per name, that's $315 in lost revenue to the state. We are not going to, we are not intending to spend many thousands of dollars it would require in the computer, computer programming, to obtain $315 in lost revenue. And therefore, Mr. Chair and members, we're asking you to change 272.48 to just make it a flat fee of $15 per filing. Now, granted, this is $315 that the IRS doesn't have to pay us, but it's actually a savings. It'll be a savings to the state. Section 2 is also about flat fees. It's about the reinstatement of foreign corporations. When I say foreign corporations, I mean not only exotic locations like Iowa and South Dakota, but also places like the United Kingdom, Canada, China, and so on. So a foreign corporation is a corporation that's incorporated under the law of any state or other jurisdiction outside Minnesota. We have about we have about 9,000 of these. Every year they have to file an annual report, which really is just an indicator that they're still around, and they have to pay $115. A number of these corporations every year fail to do that. And then their status, their authority to do business in Minnesota is revoked because they failed to pay their fee.
Yes.
A number of them later on want to come back, and that's what we call the reinstatement. In order to come back right now under the current law, they have to pay a base fee plus a tiered fee, depending on how many annual reports they've missed. So it's $250 plus $115, or $250 plus $230, or $250 plus $345, and so on and so on and so on. This is very difficult for the computer. We can't do that in the computer right now. This has to be a manual transaction. We'd like to get this into our online filing, let the computer do it. Then it can be done for the convenience of not only the businesses, which can do it 24/7, from whatever computer they're at and pay by credit card, but also for the convenience of our process, the staff, that information would get into the database right away and so it would benefit Minnesota consumers too. In order to do that, we need to go to a flat fee. What we have done is calculated to the nearest round number that makes sense for someone to remember what the fee is, and that turns out to be $500. If we wanted to make it an exact revenue-neutral amount, I think it comes out to $504.70. That's obviously not a fee anybody is going to remember. So we have it at $500. At the $500 level, there are two fiscal impacts. The first fiscal impact is there is a projected $2,800 and some odd, and this is in the fiscal note, loss to the general fund every year. This is on a base of revenues of in excess of $350,000, I think it is. So it's within 1% of being revenue neutral, and that's every year to the general fund. There are some initial computer costs, which are not general fund costs, because they will be part of, they will be funded by the technology fund that has been established over a decade ago by the legislature in 336.1-110. And so that is why these the bill is before you because it has this minor fiscal impact, again, a reduction in $3,000 each fiscal year to the general fund, plus a small amount of it's $6,000 in the first biennium, $2,000 each biennium thereafter for computer development and maintenance. And so I'd be glad to take any questions, but essentially that is the fiscal portion of this bill.
Any questions from the committee? Mr. Beck, I have one question. The revocation of the ability of an outside Minnesota business to do business in Minnesota, what happens when it's an internal business and they don't pay their renewal fee?
Right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As it happens, there is no renewal fee for a Minnesota corporation. We'd like to think that that's an incentive to come under our laws. If you do fail to file, you still have to file an annual renewal. If you fail to file, then your corporation will be administratively dissolved. However, you can reinstate that corporation at any future time. There is a nominal fee of $25, Mr. Chair. But the Minnesota corporations get a break on the filing of the annual renewal and on the reinstatement.
And Mr. Black, when a corporation is administratively dissolved, and I believe that happens after a year, is there a change in their ability to do business in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. They're no longer a corporation during that time that they have between when they were administratively dissolved and when they reinstate. When they reinstate, it's a sort of a legal, how can I describe this? It's sort of the opposite of what's known as a springing interest. It relates back to the original date of your administrative dissolution, with one exception, which is if somebody specifically relied on the fact that you were not a corporation, then as to them, you are still not a corporation. And that obviously can have some impact. Those sections, of course, are not affected by this bill.
But a business that is doing business in Minnesota but is based outside of Minnesota, they don't cease to exist. It's just that their ability to do business is essentially revoked.
Mr. Chair, that's correct, because they're under the law of another state. So, for example, if you have, as we have many corporations doing business in the state who are from the state of Delaware. Delaware is a very popular state with large corporate businesses, Fortune 500 corporations. We have a couple of our own Fortune 500 corporations here in Minnesota, but we have many of them are under Delaware law. If they were to fail to file the renewal required by Section 303, they could not do business, technically could not do business in this state, could not bring a lawsuit in this state, but their corporate existence does not end because, in fact, that's governed by the state of Delaware. And, of course, if they were to miss paying the state of Delaware the rather hefty fees that Delaware charges, then Delaware could dissolve them. Then they'd be in a world of hurt. I might add that the Secretary of State's office is glad to turn back a profit to the general fund every biennium. It's in excess of $20 million. However, the Secretary of State's office of Delaware funds about a third of their general fund. We're not Delaware.
Oh. Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Any further testimony from the audience? Senator Franson, any closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, this is a pretty simple bill, and we have a small fiscal note. That's why we're in front of this committee, and I think Mr. Black has done a wonderful job explaining the issue and why we landed with a fiscal note, but it's pretty much, in my opinion, almost a wash.
Thank you, Senator. With that, Senate File 1476 would be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Let me witnesses here, Ms. Beth Fraser. Cordano.
Senator Metzen, can you pull the microphone a little bit closer to you, point it at you?
Thank you.
At yourself?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate File 989, I'm asking for support for a central accommodation fund for hiring more people with disabilities. This is a fund housed at a central agency, probably the Department of Administration. State agencies could tap into to pay for accommodations for the job applicants and employees with disabilities. A central accommodation fund would also support the hiring of disabled private business and other government units use central accommodation funds. For example, Microsoft, IBM, SunTrust, the federal government, and the University of Minnesota. The request to set up this accommodation fund would be for $500,000, and it's done, like I mentioned, a lot of other administrations, government administrations, and the University of Minnesota. And again, I repeat, most of the major companies that I'm aware of have this accommodation in their portfolio. So with that, would you want to?
Please state your name for the record and continue with your
testimony. I'm Bobby Cordano. Mr. Chair, member of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today with you. I am happy to be here in support of the Senate File 989. I'm currently the Vice President of Program for the Wilder Foundation. And one of the reasons why I'm in this role is because I got my esteemed start in the state of Minnesota nearly 25 years ago at the Attorney General's office. I was probably was one of two lawyers who were deaf in the Attorney General's office at the time, and that was how I started my career here in this great state of Minnesota. And at that time, there was a much higher percentage of people with disabilities employed in the state of Minnesota than there is today. I'm very sad to see that the number is as low as 4%. The state is often the one of the best places for people with disabilities to get employment because there is more incentive to be inclusive and to offer employer opportunity to young people with great talent. I can speak to that, my experience myself. And I think the state of Minnesota really ranks as one of the top states in the nation as a person with a disability to work and to have opportunity to grow in one profession and advance to other fields. I have the experience after leaving the state attorney, the Attorney General's office. I went to the University of Minnesota and actually was a person who implemented the centralized fund at the University of Minnesota. And the way that that worked was that it was a way to remove incentive to not hire people with disabilities out of fear of the cost. And it's human nature to worry when you're directly responsible for a budget and you see someone come to your office like me and you say, wow, how will I pay for an interpreter? And so I was one of the people to make sure that all the colleges at the University of Minnesota would have no incentive to not invite students with disabilities, especially deaf students who can be very expensive, to not admit students who are into their colleges. And the way that we did that was to have a shared fund that everyone pitched into. And then that fund assured that wherever the need for the accommodation arose at the university in whatever part of campus, whether the public accommodation or in a classroom or as an employee, we could respond to that need. Given the shrinkage of the number of employees with disabilities in the state of Minnesota over the years and the governor's desire to see us expand that goal from 4% to 7%, I strongly encourage that you consider seeding this fund with $500,000 so as to encourage the expansion of employment opportunity for people with disability. I'd like to share a statistic with you that is a very sad one for me. The Americans with Disabilities Act was passed at about the same time that I graduated from law school. I got my first job shortly thereafter. Today, 25 years later, there are fewer deaf people employed in jobs than there were before the ADA was passed. There are fewer deaf people employed in 2015 than there was before the Americans with Disabilities Act. We have a set of perverse incentives that have worked in this country as a result of that. So I ask for your support to foster and encourage the employment of people with disabilities who bring tremendous talent to the work that they do and great passion, and to make the state of Minnesota one of the employers that wants to see them grow and flourish in their careers so they can be in places like I am today as Vice President of Programs at Wilder Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cordano.
No, you're kidding.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. I just want to point out that Minnesota, as you well know, is facing a worker shortage going forward. And so this is not just about, oh, we want to be nice to people with disabilities and hire some people with disabilities to be nice to them. This is going to be an imperative to attract and retain the best and brightest in our state. We need to attract people who have disabilities and will need to pay for their accommodations. And this is one way to make sure that we have the top quality workforce in the country. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but again, also urge your support.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Any questions from the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzen, this looks like it, you know, looks like it applies mostly for state, but could this apply to agencies across the state? I mean, it looks like it's just for like St. Paul or the agencies here, but could it apply to other agencies, say in Duluth or St. Cloud or Chester too?
I believe so,
Senator Metzen.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Great.
It's the right thing to do. It should be statewide significant.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill, the way it's written, is supposed to apply to all of the executive branch, and so it should apply to state offices wherever they are throughout the state. And there's been some discussion with Mr. Hubinger about should this apply to the legislature, and we're not there yet, but, you know, there's interest from other branches as well.
The Supreme Court had a very similar structure and made a very is it appropriate, Ms. Bitt?
Yes.
To answer your question further, the Minnesota Supreme Court, I was part of the task force that helped focus and centralize the fund for interpreters for foreign languages as well as sign language for the courts into a centralized fund to assure that all the smaller courts around the state that may not have as much exposure to the use of accommodation, especially in that case interpreters, would have access to and the experience to the access to the fund and the knowledge of how to obtain and secure the nature of kind of accommodations that are required. So this would be expertise that could be shared statewide where there may not be much.
And Senator Metzen, do you wish to comment on the number of FTEs you're adding?
Am I asking for any air? Oh, no, we're not talking about that this afternoon. Selective.
I guess to the testifiers, I'd like to ask how will this be administered so that it's administered fairly across the groups that do add employees so that one agency doesn't use it all up or doesn't use excessive amounts so that it can be proportionally used?
I guess Ms. Hartnett wants to reply.
We've got a strong bullpen here.
Ms. Hartnett, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the question. We're hoping this is the first time we'll have a fund of this kind. The Department of Admin came out with a fiscal note that puts the onus on the Minnesota STAR program. We believe that a lot of the cost is, as Ms. Cardano just stated, would be sign language interpreters, and that they don't have the expertise. So we'd like to really work with them about and put a we envision and believe and have working very cooperatively and have a great relationship with the Department of Admin about putting a group together to look and put some procedures in place to make sure that it's administered fairly, to make sure that there's the expertise in the areas of accommodation that are available within the state. For example, the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division already does a lot of work with sign language interpreters. Probably, you know, coordinating that off to that group would probably make sense. Assistive technology would make sense with the STAR program. I think we just need to work that out to make sure that there's procedures in place to make sure that it's administered fairly, and we anticipate that it will, you know, be widely used and hope that we attract the best and the brightest as a result of it. I can speak from experience posting for a position that we had a high-level position in education, and it was very difficult to recruit somebody who's deaf to come to the state. We, in the end, you know, continued to have to go up at the salary level, and in the end lost out to another state for that position. So just to be able to recruit the best and the brightest, we're going to need to have that fund in place to show that we are, you know, serious and a model employer for the state, and that we are create a welcoming environment.
Thank you, Ms. Hardnett. I guess one question of clarification on that is, you mentioned about salaries. So is this an appropriation for salary, or is it for accommodation?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we know that there needs to be some administrative cost, and that needs to be worked out. The Department of Admin came in with their estimate, you know, and you, this body will have to determine what that amount will be, but we see the focus being the fund itself, and that's what we're most concerned about. And I think,
Mr. Chair and members, the fund is for accommodations. It's not to augment salaries to hire people with disabilities.
But we do know that...
Ms. Cardano.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do know that when we are looking for employment opportunities, we will look to see how many other people are also, like, you know, hired throughout the state, and what kind of community there is for your peer group and that sort of thing. So it's very important to know that there are welcoming employers in the state to attract people from out of state, especially to the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So it's more about the peer group and looking for signs that the state will be accommodating when the need arises.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Metzen, any further testimony?
Oh, I this is the right thing to do, and I appreciate your support. And hopefully we could get some appropriations in the bill.
Anyone from the audience would like to testify for or against this proposal? Seeing none, Senate File 989 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Yep. See you. Yep. Senator Metzen has a duck spill. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I think this is really an exciting, good bill. So-called Mighty Ducks funding grant bill. Some years ago, as you remember, carried the Mighty Ducks bill because of the advent of the, particularly the women's and the girls' hockey in Minnesota. This is kind of a follow-up because there's more challenges out there, and the big challenge is the community ice centers need about 120 of the indoor arenas are approaching a deadline to replace the R22 or the Freon keeps the ice floors frozen. By the year 2020, there will be no Freon available in the country. This will be banned. So we have a big challenge here going forward. Again, I repeat, there's about 120 ice arenas. I believe most members of the committee here are involved. Most of these buildings were constructed in the 70s, and outdated equipment, the ventilation is outdated. There's been kids I know in Duluth that have been sent home sick from the carbon monoxide poisoning, and I believe that's happened at one or two other arenas in the state. And we have a challenge here, and quite frankly, 59 of the 67 senators are affected by this this act, but these communities, quite frankly, I think it's a statewide significant bill. The money is distributed equally to the 8 congressional districts, so there's no favoritism here at all. And it worked real well under the Mighty Ducks bill that I carried before. So I just think that the significance here, and the communities cannot afford $100,000 and $200,000 that it takes to convert the freezing method. I've got a couple of celebrities here. But, well, I don't know if they're celebrities, but Mr. Jim Boo from Onamita, he was on. Were you the champions that year at the University of Minnesota?
Yes, sir.
Back in 1942? No, I'm just kidding. And, you had a little stint there with the North Stars, too, is that correct?
Yes.
You were the enforcer, so we you got to work on something.
So, I'm trying to graduate out of that.
We have Mr. Osby, was a goalie at U of M, and he was a goalie coach, I believe, under my dear friend Doug Woog. So, welcome, boys. And
Thank you.
I think we're all right. I don't think we need you to testify, but if we do, it will call the strong people up here to help.
Senator, you're testifying for them.
And both of these gentlemen are members of the Herb Brooks Foundation. Is that correct? Okay. Todd, did you want to come up? We have the Amateur Sports Commission Director. And in your file, I think I have a list of the senators, particularly on this committee, that are could benefit from this legislation. Leroy Stump, Saxog, Senator Kosauka, Senator Deans, Senator Anderson, Metzen, Bonnie Joe Champion, and Richard Cohen. So this is a very serious problem statewide. And I'm really convinced that the accomplishments from the first Mighty Ducks bill was just tremendous. And I think this is a great effort to help these communities pay for this expensive change.
So, Senator, you really have two jobs here to do. One is the replacement of the refrigerant 22. And the other one is the indoor air quality, primarily looking at carbon monoxide from
absolutely. I'm glad you added that on. I didn't emphasize enough about the exchange in these buildings. And I think, and what also, a lot of these arenas aren't changed over with the Zambonis. You know, there's still gas, and that's
pretty sure it's
lots of problems, too. So this could help in that area. And like you said, the air transfer that has
air quality,
caused a lot of problems out there and health concerns. So,
in Senator, I believe we have an A1 amendment, and I think that's an author's amendment.
I'll have.
If it's an author's amendment, you.
I think it just. I don't know what have the attorney. I don't think it does anything. Just changes the dates. Is that correct? Like I called you on to make sure that. It accelerated to 50,
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen and members, because there's an appropriation in here, we wanted that to be effective for the fiscal year 2016, which starts July 1st, 2015. So it makes the policy section effective July 1st, 2015, and then it makes the appropriation in fiscal year 2016.
That's a week, Mr. Chairman, we can't wait on this. I mean, there's a deadline out there, 2020.
Oh, here it is.
And, that's why I made sure that this amendment was drafted to make sure that we could start this process this year. So I'll move the amendment.
Yeah, Senator Metzen offers the A1 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Anderson, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzen, you're asking for $5 million here to be appropriated, and you say it's going to be equally distributed between the different congressional districts. Do the hockey arena rinks or the cities themselves have to make an application then to the Mighty Ducks program within?
Yes, Yes, they do. They have to go through that process, exactly what you're saying, and the Amateur Sports Commission will determine who gets them. And it absolutely has to be the 8 congressional districts. We don't want any favoritism here at all, so it does. It worked real well when I passed the Mighty Ducks bill, whatever that was a few years back, and it worked well. And so they go ahead and make their case, and this will not get us all the way to the 100-yard line, by the way, but it's a good start. So if we give out $25,000, $50,000 grants, it'll get the ball rolling, and quite frankly, I think I'll have to come back here again. But let's get it started.
It's Senator Anderson, I bring your attention to line 2.12, the section, paragraph D there. The commission shall administer the site selection process. And it goes down to 2.30. And it tells about how the grants must be awarded to communities in greater Minnesota also.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Metzen, then, is the Sports Facilities Commission putting out a letter to all these communities now, or are we going to be waiting until, or can't we do that until July 1st?
Well, I think we can do it immediately.
Senator Metzen.
As soon as we pass, if we get some money here, we're going to do it right away, because these issues, and then it could probably be corrected during the summer months when the kids aren't, kids, adults, and whoever aren't using the arena, see, and then that's why I want to get it started right now. That's why we changed the dates a little bit.
Okay, thank you.
And it's not just hockey. These arenas are used for many purposes, what have you, and I know down in where I live in South St. Paul, Inver Grove, they use these arenas for just so many different events, so I really emphasized hockey here today, but it's not just boys and girls hockey. It's many issues that these arenas have to get updated for.
Senator Metzen, you have another testifier?
No, I think we're doing pretty good, aren't we?
Well, we haven't heard from Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Todd, did you want to, the executive director of the...
Please state your name for the record and I add
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Todd Johnson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission and the executive director of the National Sports Center up in Blaine. I'm just here to support Senator Metzen and the work that he's done historically in support of... it's really about equity for ice time and finding out ways to allow municipalities and school districts and other public entities to either initially it was to make more ice available. Those of you who have had the opportunity to see how transformational this hockey in particular, but of course figure skating and other ice sports with young women, young girls putting on a helmet and seeing how transformational that can be for their lives as well. As the more traditional things we think about when we think about ice hockey, it's really quite an asset for our state. As most of you know, sports tourism is becoming such a major factor with direct attributable assets and money coming into the state of almost $71 million a year based on facilities that you've helped fund through the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. So we're just here to support Senator Metzen. And as he stated, the senator stated, we are very ecumenical in the way that we go about distributing these resources and making sure that it's a fair distribution. Even though I'm a former Ranger, we make sure that it gets all over the state.
The Rangers, Mr. Chairman, the Rangers usually do all right at whatever we do around here.
Mr. Johnson, I'd like to ask a couple of technical questions.
I do.
For refrigerant 22, what are you replacing it with? And also, has the new technology been adopted, and about when is that? So are some of the rinks that are being built today using different refrigerants, and what is that?
Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a great question. R22, actually, this could date back to the Montreal Protocol of 1987, is when they first started being really concerned about this refrigerant. And it's been on the books for quite some time that it was no longer going to be produced, which is really the case. After 2020, it will no longer be manufactured. It can still use it if you can get it. And in some cases, a lot of facilities will be will be storing it and continuing to use it. But the major concern with this refrigerant is leaky facilities, and when it gets exposed to the atmosphere that way. Replace your question specifically about replacement technologies, they do exist. Sometimes history is best, and they're going back to using ammonia-based refrigerants. And in some cases, we've got award-winning ecological techniques being used, one in New Hope and one in Brooklyn Park, where the Environmental Protection Agency has cited made examples of them as places that have replaced this direct refrigerant of R22, replacing it with ammonia, and it's a much more efficient method of using it. Another sort of side note, which is interesting, about 3 weeks ago up at the National Sports Center in Blaine, where we run the world's largest ice facility with 8 sheets of ice, we had a group of folks, engineers from China, who came. They're about to build 1,000 ice rinks in 5 years. And we're looking at the facilities that we use there, and they were hoping that they had come up with a new method, but the method that they've come up with really wouldn't work in some of our climates because of what happens with the permafrost when you keep your ice in permanently. So it was a very interesting discussion, but all over the world, people are looking at what sort of refrigerant you can use, and it seems to us that retrofitting or moving back towards ammonia is the best way to go.
So, Mr. Johnson, are you saying that ammonia is the only alternative right now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not saying it's the only one. Right now, it's the preferred method that folks are going back to using. The Environmental Protection Agency has not approved large-scale use of the other refrigerant. I can't think of the code, but there's CO2, and then there's another refrigerant that is used in automobile. 134, 136. They have not approved large-scale use of that on facilities as large as ice rinks, which is what the folks from China they are planning to use. So we might be able to get away with it there, but we can't here yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Chairman, just...
Senator Metzen.
A couple of current and former members of the Amateur Sports Commission, Mr. Evans and Mr. Joel Carlson, that have really helped me quite a bit on this process as we're going forward, and I just wanted to acknowledge their help and on this exciting matter.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Any further testimony from the audience? Seeing none, Senate File 2002, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. I believe that is all of the business for today. It is 4:05, and we are adjourned.